20 secure phones to assist in staying anonymous, $5,000. Fighting legal cases across 5 countries, $1 million. Upkeep of servers in over 40 countries, $200,000. Donations lost due to banking blockade, $15 million. Added cost due to house arrest, $500,000. Watching the world change as a result of your work? Priceless. There are some people who don't like change. For everyone else, there's WikiLeaks.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another fun-packed, fun-filled show of the Slalomcast, episode 38 for Tuesday, July 5th, 2011. We have a full house today. With me to my right, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Howdy.
Howdy. Keep the energy up. Come on, I'm trying here.
Hi.
That's awesome. And to my left, Mr. Matt Hunt.
How's it going?
I am wonderful. How are you guys?
Very good, thanks.
Kitten BFFs.
Yeah, I'm recovering from, some...
A little inside joke from the supper.
Beer up my nose. Never mind.
Actually, was quite funny. Who would have thought that, Matt, your comment would have made Ryan spit out his drink?
I don't know. I'll see if I can do it again during the show.
Ooh. Just please don't hurt my electronics.
Well, you're drinking a squirt, Ryan. That seems ominous.
Aw. No. I fear that monitor is going to die tonight.
No, it's an HP. It probably deserves to die.
Oh, my laptop's an HP.
Oh, that too, then.
Okay. Let's get into the show before anything dies. Our first article comes from Boing Boing. And there was kind of an update to the article since I had posted it. It turns out that California was proposing a new tax law. You know, as it stands now, if you're in Pennsylvania, you buy something from Amazon, you don't have to pay sales tax. That's why everybody buys on the internet. Well, California was going to pass a law that if you bought stuff online, you still had to pay sales tax when it came time for income tax or whatever. There was some way they were going to get their sales tax. And Google's like, whoa, if you guys do this, we're going to shut down our Amazon Associates program for all California residents. And California said, screw you. They passed the bill, and Amazon immediately sent out emails to everybody in California, like, we are terminating your Amazon Associates account right now.
Hmm.
Done.
Well, the thing that you said there before, like, if you buy something from Amazon, you don't have to pay sales tax. But you do have to pay use tax. You do have to pay it. It's a law. No one pays it.
I was going to say, it's on the form. It's on the tax return. You're supposed to claim it.
Well, it's not even there. You're supposed to pay it as you buy it. It's not even, like, they remind you when you file your taxes. Like, hey, by the way, did you buy anything on the internet or through a mail order catalog?
No, I never do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a problem for 100 years because you had mail order catalogs, you know, well before the internet, and they still had to pay use tax on them. It just, they never enforced it because there was no way to enforce it.
Right. Yeah, what do you think, Matt?
I think the same thing's happened in other states before.
There have been a
Illinois,
few.
Maybe. So it's not that groundbreaking. It's just probably that California is such a big state. And this is the first I've heard that they're going after the they're counting the associates as a business entity instead of just the marketplace sellers.
Right.
I think when I've heard about it before, it's been the people selling used books and whatnot on Amazon.
Right, the third parties.
They're saying if you use the associates refer links, like a lot of bloggers do, so that, you know, they have a link in their blog entry that sends you to Amazon and it has a little tag that they get a little kickback when you buy something.
Right. It's like 3%.
Yeah.
Pretty good if somebody's buying a TV.
4+, I think. I've got my dad to buy a TV that way. Yeah.
Nice.
This is the first time I've heard them construing those participants as a business presence in a state. So that hits a lot more people, and I'm guessing we hear so much about it because there's so many bloggers and other tech people in California.
Yeah, I mean, really, Silicon Valley, like that. If you probably saw a graph of the Amazon associates, it's probably a big blob over California.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope they don't do that with Pennsylvania.
If there's a famous, another, like, sort of a blogger, sort of, I guess, I don't know. He has a website about cameras. His name's Ken Rockwell. He's been on top of this issue for a while. And he's has the same problem where he's not going to get, you know.
Is he from California?
Yeah. Loyola, I think, or somewhere. I'm not sure exactly where.
Yeah, that kind of stinks. I mean, I see Amazon's point, you know, or California's point maybe. I mean, those people are making money, you know, call it a business or not. They're making money through a structured means. I mean, well within their rights to pass the law, but.
Yeah, I think something's going to happen eventually at the national level or somewhere that's going to, you know, level the playing field between the physical stores and the online stores.
Well, that's what I was going to say. If that happens, if that's the case, how will that affect you guys' buying online? You know, because most people do it now for probably two reasons. One, no sales tax. And two, you can get stuff faster.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe not faster like if it's in-store, but if you go to a store and they don't have something, it takes them 3 days
basically
to get it shipped.
Basically, the real issue isn't speed, it's selection.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Whenever I go to the mall here, they never have what I'm looking for.
Yeah, what mall?
Yeah. So basically everything I buy from Amazon, and it's hard for me to imagine that changing just because of sales tax.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually, I think they should... I kind of agree that something might happen at the national level, but if they would just enforce the use tax laws, or people would just pay them, maybe this issue would go away, and we could keep one more thing out of the Fed's hands in terms of like what they have control over.
Now, for those who don't know what the use tax laws are, can you explain how they're similar to normal sales tax if you were to go to a store?
So basically, if you live in one state, okay, like Pennsylvania, for like we do, and we buy something from Ohio. And that company in Ohio that we bought the item from has no presence in Pennsylvania, then they have no legal reason to collect sales tax and reprimand it to the Pennsylvania state government. But by law, there are statutes that say that basically if you do that, if you're in that situation and you're a resident of Pennsylvania, you owe a use tax to Pennsylvania in the same amount of the sales tax that you would have paid. I'm not even sure where the name use comes from. It's, you know, U-S-E, use.
Right, yeah, it doesn't make sense.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't exactly know what it means. But you have to, you're legally bound to pay it. Anyone who does not pay it is in violation of the law and could be prosecuted for tax fraud. Well, tax evasion.
Yeah.
It's totally within Pennsylvania state, you know, the rights of the state police, you know, if they could bring charges against you, whatever they want, but no one does it, and no one enforces it, because up until the late 1990s, it wasn't a problem. The states weren't losing much revenue from this this reason.
Because, they enforce it from cars, because cars are expensive and you register them.
Yeah, cars are about the only thing.
Yeah, aside from that, you're right. They had no way of tracking it or...
And who's going to go through all that trouble to make you pay use tax on a book that you bought from Amazon?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, because the states have very little recourse in enforcing it, they may pass a law that, you know, at the national level, like Matt suggested, like it's sort of inevitable. But, like, I would hope that doesn't come to that. Not that I want to evade taxes, but I think we just need a better solution. Maybe the law at the national level just says that if you're in another state, you still must collect the tax and return it to the state in terms of the state that the resident's in.
If they do that, I can see nobody selling stuff on the internet.
Well, I don't know.
Like, how bad would that suck if you sold something and people from all over the country could buy stuff, and at the end of the month or whatever, you had to go through all of your sales and be like, oh, this $1.25 goes to California, this $1.30 goes to Pennsylvania.
I mean, you can handle all that stuff through the banks and payment processors and stuff like that. They always make it out like it's a computationally intractable problem to figure out what the tax amount due is.
Yeah.
But if you look at the things that they managed to do successfully, it doesn't seem like that hard a problem to solve.
Yeah, there are some intricacies in the state laws, and like each state's different, and then it depends on if the parties are from states that are in part of their what are they called, reciprocity agreements and stuff like that, because states have all these reciprocity agreements of like whether or not their laws apply, and it's ridiculous. But there's some intricacies to this completely solving it across all states, but if people would just pay the use tax, it would be over with. And here's the thing, though. If they, no matter what happens, say people pay the use tax, say the companies collect the use tax and pay to the state, say they enforce a national law, this is not going to make people, I don't think it's going to cause business to go up at the local level, because the locals will have even less reason to compete. Like, the thing that bothers me about locals is, like, yeah, they don't have a price advantage, but how about giving me a selection advantage? If you had the products that I want and you had hours that were not 8 to 5 when I'm working...
That kills me about banks, too.
Right. Well, banks have at least Fridays they stay open on evenings. But most stores, like a lot of local stores, they won't stay open on the weekends or after hours. And it's like, hey, do you think I'm going to take off work to come shopping? Right. Are you an idiot? Like, I'm sorry. I mean, they're not going to do it. Take off Monday if you're in the retail business or something and work on Saturday. I know you lose your weekend, but... That's the rope.
Do you want to make money?
Yeah, I can go on Amazon and buy anything any time of the day. So.
Yeah, I always think it's funny when stores are only open business hours. You're basically targeting the unemployed as your clientele, and that seems like a losing business proposition.
Right. Yeah,
me.
I mean wait, time's up.
I don't know if you guys heard that. I forgot to turn off my Google notifier, and I just got an email.
Man, I always do that.
Well, it's probably a good way to get us off this topic, because I could rant forever.
Next story. So we talked about Google Plus coming out last week, and it seems that this is having some weird side effects. The one that we're going to talk about right now, an article from TechCrunch, that real-time search on Google is not there anymore. If you've noticed, certain times whenever you're searching on Google, if you're logged into Twitter at the same time, and sometimes even if you're not, you'll see Twitter posts in your Google search results. And that was an agreement. You know, Google had the fire hose from Twitter to get everything they wanted. And now it's not there.
Google had real-time search?
Really?
No, I knew about it.
Yeah.
But I just never used it. That's kind of my point.
Yeah, I don't. Anytime I see Twitter results in Google, I just ignore them and scroll past them. But I guess some people use them, and now it's not there.
I've used them when people delete their tweets.
Oh,
sometimes they stick around in Google Instant Search.
Okay, here's a pet peeve of mine. Twitter, the way they redesigned their interface with direct messages makes it look like emails. So I'll have a direct message conversation with somebody, and it'll be stuff that I want to reference later on. Like, I send them something, and I want to know what I said because it's a time or place or something. But these people, because the way the website is designed, they think it's an email, and they delete them all. But because Twitter is designed so crappily, not only do they delete theirs, they also delete mine. Twitter lets people delete the other person's direct messages. So I can't even see my direct messages anymore.
That's crap.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's horrible. Like, just one of my friends did this, and I'm like, oh, it disappeared from my tweet deck too? What's going on?
Huh, that's weird.
Okay, so anyways, Twitter from Google. Do you guys care? Do you see this as being a big deal now that Google is kind of trying to take over Twitter and Facebook and every other social place? No big deal.
I mean, I think it's definitely like a sort of a shot across the bow, and like in the sense, like, you're not going to be no longer relevant in 6 months.
Like Google telling Twitter that?
Right. I mean, I could see it maybe being taken that way.
Yeah, I guess what I've read is that Google wanted the data not so they would have an exhaustive database of every tweet, but to find out what was going on in the world.
Right.
And so if you get, you know, 1% or 10% of Twitter's user base in Google Plus, then you don't need that anymore to figure out what's going on. So I guess it makes sense from Google's standpoint. But those of us who liked it as a side effect of having them indexing all the tweets, we lose that. But I don't really care that much.
Yeah. Do either of you have an account on Google Plus yet?
No, I got an invitation, but when I click on the invitation, it says they're not accepting additional signups.
That happened to me the first time, and then I got another one, and it let me in for some reason, and I can't invite anybody now. Like, I've tried to invite people. There's been articles about, like, quote-unquote backdoor ways to invite people, and even that didn't work.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to, like, hammer on you for not inviting me.
Yeah, I tried. It just doesn't work for some reason.
Actually, I did get an invite too, and when I think when I logged in, I did the same thing yours did, where it said they're no longer accepting them.
Well, the cool thing is you can still participate in Google Plus via email, like replying to the email chains. Mm-hmm. If somebody sends you a post through an email, you just can't have an account to log in. I don't know.
Is it like a separate account, or is it just use your whole Google account?
It's your Google account.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the black bar. You guys have noticed the black bar?
Oh, yeah.
That's why that's there. Now, whenever you go to any Google page and you're signed in, the top left... actually, let me just open it up so you guys can see. I gave them a monitor, so now they can see exactly what I see. So the top left now, you'll see a plus in your name.
Oh.
So that's how you know that you have a Google Plus account, and that's how you get to it.
Wow, Kevin outranks the web.
Oh, yeah. I am first. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see all the side effects of Google trying to take over everybody.
I wonder if I could see your like page code and like copy the JavaScript out of it to put that in the bar.
Huh. Do it.
We'll have to try it after the
Then
after
you can
the
be Kevin. But speaking of Facebook, there's an article here from AOL, of all places, AOL Jobs. Now you could lose a job because of something you liked on Facebook. Now, this has been something people have talked about, you know, forever. Be careful what you post on the internet. Companies could see it, fire you or not hire you. But this goes into a little bit more detail on how that happens. You know, this article doesn't talk about companies Googling you or Facebooking you when you come in for an interview. This article talks about companies like Social Intelligence. They're a background check company, and they basically invade our rights. I mean, they don't legally, but, you know...
Well, just because a court said so.
Yeah. A court said they didn't, but they really do.
I'd like to hear what the mob says.
Yeah. Get the mob after them. But this company, Social Intelligence, you know, companies are going to them to run background checks on people that include the internet, whereas before it was just like a criminal check or a drug check. Now this company like has Twitter, Flickr, MySpace, you know, everything on the internet. They Google you, they find out everything they can about you, and they give it to companies. What do you think, Matt? Are you afraid?
I've seen how well the proxy software that blocks you from allegedly pornographic websites or gambling sites or sex sites or whatever, and my fear is that they work just as well as those blocking packages.
Which is to say, not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you care about this, Ryan? I mean,
well, I mean, I don't. I looked up the Social Intelligence company because I hadn't heard of them before, and I didn't like what I read. I mean, it just basically sounds like they're building like, you know, similar to what a credit report would be on someone. And labeling them as racists, like if they say something, like maybe it was racist, but I mean, I don't. Isn't that slightly like defamation? Can that
be
considered?
I mean, it seems a little. You know, a credit report's a pretty objective thing. You paid the bill. You didn't pay the bill.
Right.
You're this long overdue. This is a little more into screening people on political opinions, social opinions, things like that.
Yeah, like what good's the right to free speech when you
can't
get
it.
A job because you exercise that right.
And it seems almost like it's getting close to putting prospective employers in a bad situation where they're evaluating people based on political factors or free speech factors that maybe they're not really allowed to evaluate job candidates on.
Interestingly enough, if you read Social Intelligence's website, they compare the two ways of doing it their way or doing it like through Google. And they're like, they cite the exact things you just said, like, oh, if you do it through us, you'll be legal. Like, what you can legally, like, discriminate against.
They
so
have
it's
the
like,
win-win solution.
Yeah, it's like, oh, this is legal discrimination.
So if you say you're pregnant, they filter that out probably because that's not something employers are allowed to ask about.
I don't know.
I think this company can get around all of that.
They might be able to.
You know, this company can be the extreme invaders of your privacy and just give the company who contracted them a go or no go on hiring you, and if they take their word for it.
Yeah, like let's just read this. So it says it on their website, it says employers are in a bind. If employers Google job candidates, then employers are vulnerable to discrimination charges and other legal risks, and job candidates are vulnerable to having their privacy violated. But if employers don't Google job candidates, they're not making the best efforts, you know, to screen applicants. So they're saying, you know, use us. So like we'll do it we'll skirt the law and get around the problems with discrimination. So you can like choose who you want to work. I mean, private companies have a right to choose who they want for their to work for them. But it should be, in my opinion, it should be based on references and skills, like, you know, and what a lot of jobs I'm seeing now, they have like 6 month trial periods. They're starting now.
Right.
Like that's it was something I never heard of until recently, and you know, that's just what, you know, friends are telling me. Like, oh, yeah, it's like an evaluative process where if you do well after 6 months...
Yeah, your contract
like,
work.
Yeah, or like probation for whatever, you know.
I think that's actually a good idea. Because if somebody went and took a look at my Facebook page right now, because I wanted to get a job, they would have seen my last picture, which was I posted the beer that I just drank down at the South Side.
Yeah.
And they could look at that and say, oh, this guy's a drunk. We're not going to hire him.
Right. So, like, it just basically... I mean, maybe that's their right to do, but there's also, there's, you know, there's things that they're not allowed to discriminate on. So, like, who starts to decide what you can discriminate on and what you can't?
Social intelligence.
Exactly. This is bullshit.
I agree. So, our next article, I just kind of threw this in there because, you know, it is interesting. Robert Morris died, 78 years old. Have either of you... Now, I'm going to say this because I didn't know until I read the article. Have either of you heard of this Robert Morris?
I heard of his son.
Yes.
And at first, my immediate reaction was, I had no idea he was so old.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, yeah. Then I read the obit and realized that the one that I knew about was the author of The Morris Worm.
Right. That's the one most people know about.
And...
I feel like a really bad nerd because I didn't know about either of them.
He was the first worm inventor. Like,
the only reason
the
I recognize
one.
The name is because of the university, Robert Morris.
That was a different one.
Yeah, so that's the third one.
Yeah.
So our Independence Day toast goes to the original Robert Morris, signer of the Declaration of Independence.
But yeah, this guy worked at the NSA. He was their chief scientist. And as I was reading this, they didn't go over the fact that it was his son that wrote the virus. And I'm thinking, holy crap, this guy who was a chief scientist for NSA wrote the first worm and deployed it across the internet. I'm like, oh, it's not the same guy.
I read, I think, the New York Times obit, which went into detail on his son's worm.
Yeah.
Which really cleared things up for me.
Yeah, yeah, that had me going for a while.
I really like the question that he said that he posed to colleagues, that the number sequence... I sat and stared at it for a while. Did you guys catch that?
Where is that in that article?
Yeah, it's at the bottom.
Oh, I didn't read that far.
Yeah, so...
1, 11, 21. What?
Yeah.
I've seen the sequence before.
I hadn't, and I really love pattern matching. Like, they're like my favorite puzzles. I couldn't get it. I was stumped for... And then I read, you know, obviously I read it, the solution.
The look and say sequence.
Yeah.
So explain it real quick for those people
okay,
who are
so
looking at
the
this.
Sequence is 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 1. So the way it works is the first number is 1. So the second number is what I would say if I saw a 1, 1, 1. Then the third number is what I would say if I saw the previous number, 2 1s, 2, 1.
Oh.
And then the fourth number is then 1, 2, 2 1s. So, or I'm sorry,
okay.
1, 2, 1, 1.
I see.
So it's kind of like the vocalization of the word or of the numbers.
So basically, this would be used as an interview question with Microsoft and would pretty much guarantee that I would not get hired.
Yeah. it's really interesting. And then even when I saw the solution, I was like, wait, what? Wouldn't there be 2s and 1s in it? But the last one is 3, 1, 2, 2, 1, 1. So it's neat.
It takes some time to look at it.
Yeah. Definitely harder than the Fibonacci sequence. So
I like the Fibonacci sequence. It's a nice sequence. Our next article, we had talked about Thunderbolt a while ago and how it's the new standard. You know, it's...
I know. It's an awesome phone, isn't it? It's like the standard now.
Thunderbolt.
What an inconvenient naming of products.
Seriously.
Like, they come out at the same time. Did they not coordinate this stuff?
Don't companies talk? But yeah, so Thunderbolt, copper wire that does 10 gigabits up and down, duplex. Never been done before. You know, amazing. That's what everybody's saying it is. And everybody...
I don't think it's fast enough.
Well, everybody just thought, you know, oh, this is copper wire. You know, we could just make our own cables. This is awesome. And everybody else was like, why can't I buy one of these? You know, Macs had come out with Thunderbolt ports for the past couple months. There have been... very few Thunderbolt accessories, but there have been no Thunderbolt cables. You couldn't buy a cable to actually hook things up. And this article from Hot Hardware takes apart the cable and shows just why. It turns out that copper is not good enough to do 10 gigabits up and down, you know, to do full duplex 10 gigabits. So what they had to do is put microchips on the end of each cable to do some, I don't want to say the wrong thing. It's clever error correction and filtering to make sure that the data goes faster than it's supposed to be able to go on copper. So I want to hear you guys' opinion on this. What do you think in terms of, you know, who's cornering this market? Because right now, it's pretty much Apple. You know, if you want a Thunderbolt cable to go with your Thunderbolt accessory, you're going to Apple for it. Should Apple own a technology medium like this?
That doesn't do a lot for me. My hope would be that we get inexpensive commodity cables in the near future. Even if they still need the signal processing chips in the cables, I would hope that we get competition driving the price well below the $50 that we have now.
Yeah, $49.99. Yeah.
I mean, an HDMI cable doesn't have this active electronics in it, but when they first came out, they were also very expensive just because it's a high bandwidth connection. They, you know, need to be, you know, balanced.
Right.
And everything. Yeah. But those have gotten very cheap. I'm hoping the same thing happens with this.
I mean, my opinion is I just hope USB 4.0 comes out in a couple of years and renders it utterly useless. Because this is just silly. I just think it's silly. Like, we don't need the bandwidth right now, honestly.
Well, we don't.
We don't. But no one with a MacBook needs it either. It's just ridiculous.
I'm sure the people who are, you know, doing like NBC's video editing are thinking this is the best thing ever because now they can move files across their SANs and
there's other interconnects that are much more robust and better and cheaper cables and everything else.
There are, but it's not
fiber
a one
channel
cable.
Stuff isn't cheap though.
Well, I guess not.
And it's also not a one cable system. You know, you have one cable coming out of your machine that does everything. Power, video, data transfer, everything. Mm. Like, that's pretty cool.
I'm still skeptical. We'll see.
I am too. I've never used it. If it does everything it's supposed to do, it's amazing. I just don't like having to go to Apple and pay $50 for a cable.
You know, you mentioned the HDMI cables, the expensive ones. You know, they're like ones that are they're really pricey, and there's ones that are like cheap.
Monster.
There's actually, I read an article on Slashdot. There's a retailer in England. They're like sort of like a Target or a Walmart type place, I think, in England. And they're actually like giving their HDMI cables away free. Because they want to compete with the big box stores that are trying to sell people. And they're like, they have big ads. Like, look, these cables don't cost that much. You can have them for free if you buy the TVs from us.
I happened upon a sale that Amazon was running. I got, excuse me, I got like 10 cables for like $6.
Yeah.
They were selling the cables for a penny, literally a penny a piece. Yeah. And I just had to pay shipping.
Yeah.
Yeah. People just don't realize that it's just copper cable. Like, there's nothing special. It's the connector. You can buy the cheap ones. You don't have to buy the $80 monster ones.
Yeah, all the money's in the connector, and if it's on there, you got it. If it fits and you get a picture, you're good.
I totally agree. So we're going to jump now to a new segment in this long cast. I apologize for not getting to this question quicker, but we've been having some trouble coming up with an answer. But we think we have a good solution for this. So we have a viewer question. So I mentioned it before and after. If you want to write us a question, you're having a problem, don't know how to fix it, want to get our opinion on something, send it to... slongcast@kevinslonka.com, and we will get that email and we will attempt to answer your question on the show. So this question, Owen from Johnstown writes him, he's in the Johnstown area, he has an iPad 2 with 3G, and he wants to use it for work, but because of various security and technical reasons, he can't access the websites that he needs to or the computer. I'm assuming that the browser on the iPad won't display the sites correctly. But we're going to assume that he needs to access websites plus hit internal things. So he asks us, what's the easiest way to remotely access his computer at work through VPN using his iPad? And he wants us to keep it simple. He says his technology is limited, just that he knows VPN exists and he doesn't know how to use it. So how does he do this? So everybody pretty much came up with some good suggestions. Matt, do you want to start with what you were thinking?
Yeah, I found a webpage that maybe Kevin can put on the blog or the show notes that lists Apple's supported protocols for VPN. And these include L2TP, which I think is what Cisco uses for VPNs.
Right.
So if you have Cisco networking equipment, you may already be in good shape for that. Unfortunately, the first thing that came to mind for me for OpenVPN solutions, free VPN solutions, to put on the server was OpenVPN, and it didn't look to me like that was compatible with this list of protocols. So I think Ryan had a suggestion for what might work.
Well, before you mention that, the bottom line on your thing, Matt, is that if they do have Cisco equipment, like if his laptop has a Cisco VPN client, then his iPad is good to go. It can already VPN in because there's VPN built into iOS.
But the having a VPN client on the laptop doesn't help with that.
No, I'm just saying that's how he would know that his company has Cisco VPN equipment.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're using the Cisco tools,
then you're good to go on your iPad.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you don't know that, if you don't want to do the hardcore VPN way, Ryan, what did you have that was a little easier?
Well, I've heard, you know, a lot of good things about GoToMyPC. They provide a solution that basically... I think the software runs on the host PC. So if he's on his iPad at home, his work PC would run this GoToMyPC. And obviously, he'd probably have to talk to his IT staff to get that installed.
Well, yeah, you'll get in trouble if you do it without consulting your IT staff.
Yeah, so you're going to want to consult your IT staff with this. And they may actually like this, if it allows you to work from home. And I think it's pretty secure.
It's AES, SSL encrypted. It's good to go.
In terms of encryption, they shouldn't have any problem with it. It's very similar to VPN. And it allows you to access your PC through any web browser anywhere in the world. And it actually is going to use your work computer to render the pages and then present it to you in an interface that is sort of abstracts away any of those incompatibilities that you're experiencing with the iPad. And a lot of people like it. Actually, I had a problem with my Dell computer a couple years ago. It was 6 months ago. And the staff that logged into my computer actually used a light version of that they sort of a commercial software version of it that Dell uses to log in your PC. They tell you to go to a web page. It quickly installs this little host app. And bam, they had access to my PC, and they were able to troubleshoot it over the internet. And then when they were done, they logged out, and it cleaned itself up and uninstalled. It was pretty slick.
I've done that with somebody too to help them with a computer problem. Yeah, it works great.
And then the only other thing I was wondering is wouldn't maybe remote desktop? Is there any remote desktop apps for iPad?
The thing that I was going to say to add to Matt's suggestion, if you can VPN in. If you can just go into your network connections in your iPad, enter your VPN credentials, and get into your computer's network, there are VNC viewers. Mm-hmm. So you can install a VNC server, small app on your work computer, and then get the VNC viewer on your iPad, and then remote desktop. See your work computer.
And that's VNC. It's separate. It's a different...
Yes, virtual network something computing. Yes. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not related to VPN. It's
a separate app.
It's a separate application, completely different. But yep.
Yeah. So two suggestions for you, Owen. First one, if you know that your company uses Cisco VPN, your iPad can already do that. So you can just VPN in as normal through your network properties and use something like VNC to see your desktop. Or if you don't want to go that route, you can use a product such as GoToMyPC, which actually you do have to pay for. So you will have a monthly fee to use GoToMyPC, but it's well worth it if you just don't want the hassle and your IT department is giving you hassles about VPN because it kind of just works. So give that a shot. Let us know. We'd love to hear whether it worked or not and what you chose. So let's move on. You probably noticed during the opening of the show, it wasn't our normal opening. It was actually a video that... I'm sorry. Am I talking about the wrong thing? I am talking about the wrong thing. Yes. I got my stories mixed up. I could have swore that I put that as the first article in the security section, but I obviously did not. So I'm an idiot. Our first article in the security section from Forbes is that we have WikiLeaks. Everybody had heard of WikiLeaks before. Now we have a WikiLeaks for hackers called HackerLeaks. And this was created by the hacking group Anonymous. So just like WikiLeaks is about, spilling secrets on governments and stuff, HackerLeaks is kind of about spilling secrets on other hackers and other things of the sort. So have either of you visited the HackerLeaks site?
No.
I have not either. I'm a little afraid.
Yeah.
I mean, the link is right here in the article, hackerleaks.tk. I don't want to click it. At least not on this machine because
where
I don't have...
Where is .tk?
I don't know.
I don't even know.
.tk domain. Let's see what
Turkmenistan.
That could be.
We should have a quiz show.
and just start naming off.
All it is it's the top level domains. You have to name the country.
Tokelau.
Tokelau.
Where's Tokelau?
Who knows?
I'm guessing that...
Oh, a territory of New Zealand located in the South Pacific.
Yeah, I'm guessing that this domain name registry is like 10% of their GDP.
They just need people to take it. Tokelau. So anyways, idea, bad idea.
Well, so what I read was that it's a place for any hackers who's like, I guess, hacked or stolen information that would be of a newsworthy, I don't know if you want to call it newsworthy, would be interesting to someone to come and post it there.
Right. You don't have to be a member of an official group. You can just be a single person. You have some cool information. Go post it.
I mean, obviously, I think what they've taken is probably illegal, so I don't condone it. I think this is like vigilante stuff.
Well, that's what these groups are anyways.
Well, right, but I still don't agree with it. I mean, I think there's better ways to go about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have anything to say, Matt? I mean, that's pretty much how I feel.
I thought they all use Pastebin.
Honestly, I've stumbled across a couple Pastebins with people's credit card information, addresses, phone numbers, CVVs, like thousands of them.
What's a Pastebin?
Pastebin is a website, anonymous website that you can just go to, paste in text, and it gives you a link that you can then send to people, and they can go and view that pasted text that you pasted on the site. So it's just like a text dump website.
Mm.
And hackers use this to post credit card information that they've stolen and other things.
Yeah, all the LulzSec accounts that they hacked, they were putting up on Pastebin and tweeting the Pastebin URL.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I forget how, like, I was trying to search for something about my credit card. I think it was because there had come out something like Visa got hacked, you know, search these certain terms to see if yours shows up. And I found a Pastebin link, and it's like, here's 1,000 credit cards and all the information you need to buy stuff with them. Like, jeez. It's just out there on the free internet. Don't even have to be a hacker to get it.
Hmm.
So if you are a hacker, this site's for you. If you're not, don't visit it because I can't guarantee that you're not going to get pwned.
You'll ever make it home alive.
Very true. Our next article from the Boy Genius Report is that Apple happened to be the latest target of Anonymous. Now, this isn't a big story because Anonymous kind of just, you know, hacked in, released 27 usernames and passwords, and then said, we got bigger fish to fry. We don't really want to hack Apple. We're done.
We've got bigger fish to fry? Oh, I don't know.
Well, as far as big fish, Apple's pretty big. But what they want to go after, Apple's not a government with, you know, the type of information they actually want to steal.
Yeah.
Either of you heard why they went after Apple for this?
Probably because they can.
Yeah.
I think it's a show of competence.
Yeah, like, look at what we did.
Yeah.
Well, they're giving them, like, a pass. It's like, oh, you use BSD and, like, the kernel of your operating systems. We'll give you a pass.
Right.
Well, fix your security problems or suffer the wrath.
Yeah, LulzSec did the same thing with the British National Health System, I think, right? They hacked into them and got a bunch of credentials and said, look, we like the work you're doing. We're not releasing all this stuff. Just fix your shit.
Yeah.
See, that's what these people should be doing, you know?
Well, then they'd just be white hats.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. That's what they should be doing.
I don't disagree. I mean, here's the thing. These guys that are doing this, the Anonymous and LulzSec and blah, 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 all these different organizations, they're going to start an electronic war. They are, because we have this thing now where it's like, you know, electronic attacks will be met with, what was the word?
Kinetic.
Kinetic force.
Yeah. You hack us, we put a missile down your chimney.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to start a war. So quit it.
Or do it the right way, the white hat way.
I really hope IP geolocation gets better before that happens.
Well, you know, did we have an article on here about that?
About IP geolocation?
Yeah.
No.
There's some researchers that have been working on it, and they actually are using like the speed of like electricity through copper to come even closer. Like, they can get you with no other information.
An article a couple weeks ago that kind of did something like, it did multiple paths to you, and it figured out based on the speed of the routers, you know, where you were, but nothing about electricity, at least in that article.
I thought it was based on the cable length or something.
It might have been, but it was more like, you know, speed from router to router that they figured out where these routers were placed.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. Anyway, so it's coming, Matt, soon.
Very soon. So our next article. also from Forbes, is what I talked about earlier and what the intro to the show was about. Still talking about WikiLeaks. So apparently on WikiLeaks' website, they offered to take donations, and you were able to donate using your Visa or MasterCard. I don't know why you would want to donate to a group of possible hackers, you know, with your credit card, but they did it.
Well, they probably got the credit card numbers off Pastebin like you did.
That's true. Donate with somebody else's money. But at least as of, I don't see a date. Oh, July 1st. Visa and MasterCard said, yeah, we're done. We're putting up a blockade. You can no longer accept donations via us. We're not doing it anymore. Mm-hmm. So WikiLeaks is going to sue them. Do they have ground to stand on?
I don't know. I mean, what the article says is that there's treaties between the countries in the EU, and that this violates the treaty because it's they're using a dominant position to infringe upon other companies' like ability to in the market or their presence in the marketplace.
Yeah, that was pretty much the exact quote. This is clearly an abuse of their market dominance. Oh, excuse me. I got a tickle in my throat. Cannot get that out of there.
She had some squirt.
I should have had some squirt. This water is not doing it. But yeah, this is just going to be kind of funny that, you know, you have WikiLeaks suing somebody. You know, like the company or gathering of people who don't want to be in the legal system, they're putting themselves in the legal system to do this.
No, I mean, I know what Bradley Manning did. That's the guy's name, right? That like originally
the intelligence analyst, who's believed to leak the
stuff. He's allegedly the guy that leaked it. Mind you, he's been in prison now for how many days without being charged? I think
a long time.
Yeah, he hasn't been charged yet. Now he is in the military, so they have that right to do that. But he is still an American citizen. Anyway, I'm not saying what he does right, but I still think he deserves some kind of like trial or whatever.
Well, yeah, everybody deserves a trial.
That's how we know if he did anything, right?
Right, exactly. Right. So he's still alleged. We don't really know much other than that they're saying that they think he did it.
Yeah, point being, he was not caught red-handed.
Right.
So.
Or, yeah, I guess that's the word. But what did, like, we don't know that WikiLeaks did anything in violation of the law. I don't know that.
And even if they did, it's not our law. You know, they're not in our country. So. Right.
But I don't think that. I'm sure it's not, you know, MasterCard United States that they're trying to sue. They're probably suing, like, MasterCard Europe or something.
Yeah, I think it says that.
Yeah, so, but nonetheless, like, they have some claim, I think, some legitimate claim. Like, the company has not been found with, like, specific wrongdoing that I don't know of. I mean, I have no idea. I don't know, because it's not, like, they're not telling us anything.
Yeah.
You know, if there was a trial and they, you know, actually said, oh, okay, you're being found guilty, then I would accept that, but they're not telling us that, so.
Yeah, it's interesting that they're going to sue for $15 million.
Yeah.
A, how do you prove that you lost $15 million because they took down their donation portal?
My guess is they would use some kind of, like, statistics based on the amount of donations that came in before the date they were cut off and frequency of donation and all that other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way they could do it.
Yeah, you know, use heuristics.
I wonder who's going to show up in the courtroom as WikiLeaks.
Yeah.
Well, it's not going to be Julian Assange because he's on house arrest.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I'm not siding with these guys, but I still think that, you know, they probably, if you don't charge them with something, with criminal negligence or whatever, which I know they're trying to get Assange, but that's on like child porn or something, right?
Oh, they can't get
him on sexual assault.
Yeah, they can't get him on the actual things. So they were able to get him on sexual assault in another country, part of the EU, willing to extradite him to the US.
Right. So, anyway.
Yeah, interesting stuff. So, what is this story about, Ryan, from Business Insider about fake microchips?
Oh, well, okay. I've got to put a qualifier on this. After I submitted the article, I read some more sources. And it's not really super accurate.
You heard that here, folks. We have a fake article.
Oh, you know what? And it looks like they might have updated the title because, well, okay. So here's the title. The Navy bought fake Chinese microchips that could have disarmed U.S. missiles. So could have means if they were smart enough, the counterfeiters, to hack the chip.
And put some extra code in.
And put some extra code in it and then have a way to, like, enable it remotely
So basically they're saying if these people were smart enough to put, oh, what was the name of that? The worm. The thing that
the
took
Morris
out
worm.
The Morris worm.
No, no, no. Oh. The one that took out the nuclear things in Iran.
Stuxnet.
Stuxnet. If they were clever enough to put Stuxnet on this chip, that could target the U.S. missiles.
Yeah, and then they'd have to have a way to like remotely enable it, or it'd have to be like, it'd have to be really good hack, right?
Yeah, you probably don't want it to go off until there's actually a war or something, because otherwise it just annoys people.
Wait until big red button equals pressed, then disable.
Yeah, or whatever. So, I mean, but anyway, what happened was last year the Navy bought, they have a big purchasing budget. They buy parts for missiles, planes, tanks, whatever. Who knows? Well, no, the Navy doesn't have any tanks.
Actually, they probably do.
I don't think so.
They have locomotives.
Do they really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the Air Force has more ships. The Navy has more planes. I mean, it's crazy stuff.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they bought all these microchips, and it turned out they were counterfeit. That's really end of story. But then there was some. This article actually links to a Wired article that was a couple days before it, and the Wired article basically just says that, you know, they did a study and they know this is a pretty big like security hole, like they need to like find a way to detect the counterfeit chips before they're used in anything, and more so if they're not counterfeit, were they modified?
Here's an idea. If the return address is not Cisco, return them.
Cisco?
Cisco was the big one that a lot of military companies were buying, like counterfeit routers, you know, because somebody had gotten their hands on them. And
I got you. Yeah.
But as far as the chips go.
I mean, Newegg was selling counterfeit Intel processors.
So really?
Yeah. Well, a few months ago, they were selling counterfeit Core i7s. And if Newegg can get counterfeit product in their supply chain, then it's pretty scary.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Well, I worked for a computer shop, and we had gotten, you know, we ordered a big, this is back, you know, when it was still Windows 95 we were installing. We got like a package like of OEM licenses, and they were counterfeit. You could, like, if you looked at the licenses, you could tell they were counterfeit licenses. Like, the CDs looked real, but the licenses were like, and all the paperwork was all like fake. So
yeah, I remember the empty box processors on some site. Was that also Newegg? Like they would sell you the processor, but when you got it, there was nothing in it.
Oh yeah, that may be what I was talking about. That they were supposed to be retail box Core i7s, but they were actually like a square,
like a
tile
chip
or
something.
Cardboard.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, not just counterfeit, not even a processor.
Right.
Yeah. Well, anyways, this is one reason why, and I if you read the. There's comments on the Wired article. People are just like, you know, there's certain things that you have to have made domestically or by a very close ally, not by a country who has no interest in whether you succeed or fail.
Right. Or countries who have a very big interest in you failing.
Yeah, that too.
Do not buy microchips from North Korea. Bad idea.
I don't think they could make North. Whatever. Anyway.
So anyways, before we get into our last few articles, I wanted to bring up Google+, because I just got an invite, and it seems like a lot of people have gotten invites either the real way or through some back channel way, so it's not just like the tech journalists in California who have invites now. You know, I got one from my friend that I used to work with. He works in Pittsburgh now. I don't know how he got it, but you know, normal people are getting them. But we all know about the idea behind Google+ and your friends on Google+, and that's the circles idea. We talked about it last week. We had that story on the show a year ago about the dude and his slideshow about, you know, you have this group of friends from here and this group of friends from here, and you don't want them to see the same thing. So I wanted to bring up to you guys and just talk about it for a couple minutes. Now that we have the ability to group our friends from the ground up, because none of us have friends on Google+, you know, once we get our account, we start fresh. How are you guys considering grouping your friends? I mean, this is a big deal to get this right from the beginning, because once you get 2,000 friends, you don't want to go back through and have to reorganize.
I'm pretty sure I don't have 1,000 friends.
Well, what? No. A couple hundred. You still don't want to go through and reorganize a couple hundred.
Yeah, I think I divide things up mostly on two axes. One is there's people who know me in person and might want to know that my cat has hairballs and is in the cat hospital for his hairballs. And then there's people who don't know me personally and don't want to hear about that, and you know, being sort of generous to myself, they just want to hear my opinions on technology or politics or something like that, but not, you know, the details of my personal life, because they don't really know who I am.
I like to hear when your cat has hairballs.
I'll text you every time.
Can we send up text alerts on your cat's hairballs?
Yeah, we can totally do that. The other axis is there's people who sort of get my jokes and and what I'm talking about. And then there's other people, like my aunts and uncles, who are good people who don't see life through the sarcastic and ironic lens of the internet like I do. Yeah. So, I'd sort of divide people up into that axis of whether they're going to get the sort of oddball references I make and follow along with that stuff, or if they're just going to, you know, take everything at face value and wonder why my cats use poor grammar.
I can't have cheeseburger?
Yeah. So I think that's sort of the biggest way I would divide people up is along those axes of sort of how personal our relationship is, and basically how congruent our interests and tastes and humor is versus, you know, the sort of normal civilians who don't quite get everything I'm leaning at.
So how would you do that in terms of circles? Would that be four separate circles?
Yeah, I don't know yet. I haven't gotten into Google Plus, so I have to think about that a little bit more. I definitely haven't been that successful in Facebook at dividing people up.
I have all one big group on Facebook. I can't do it.
Yeah. For me, it's a three-dimensional Venn diagram.
I don't know.
I'm kidding. Honestly, I think a lot of it, for me, what it boils down to is just like families, coworkers, and friends, you know, like
that's really the thing that they go for already. Like they give you the three bubble method, and that's kind of how it's already set up.
Yeah.
See, here's the thing that gets me with splitting up your friends like this. So, yes, there are times you want some people to know something and other people to not know something. But in order to post that, like, posting is the difficult part. Because the way I post things now, I take out my phone, I send a text message to Twitter, and it goes out to every one of my friends automatically.
Mm-hmm.
It is not going to be that easy to send out posts to Google Plus. Even if they give you a text message number, how am I going to send out a text message and say, this text goes to this circle, this text goes to these two circles, this text goes to everybody?
Easily.
Really?
There's a 2-bit code on the end of everything, and if you like, you want circle one, it's one.
Okay, so for non-computer science people,
well, then 1, 2, and 3, or like, you know, or A, B, and C.
But do you see what I mean, though? Like, it's, yes, these circles are perfect for splitting people up, but the act of sharing information now becomes significantly harder.
Yeah, I bet they're banking on everybody using a smartphone application rather than SMS.
Yeah,
it's to me it's one extra step, and even with SMS, I still think it could be, it's still, you know, it just basically you'd write your tweet basically, or your post, and at the end you just, in order, you put the groups you wanted to go in, like, you know, A, B, C, groups A, B, and C. I want A and B, so you have A, B. I want B and C, B, C. You know, just,
or one group for all or whatever.
Yeah, or something.
Yeah, see, like the way my stuff works now is it's a Twitter to everybody else kind of paradigm. I want to be able to do a Google Plus to everybody else, because Google Plus will have my real groupings of friends split up the way I want them to be. So I would like to submit to Google Plus and have Facebook pull that and have Twitter pull that. But I need that app to be easy to use and not suck, or else it's going to be too many steps and I'm going to hate it. I don't know if anybody else cares about that, but that's why I like Twitter.
Well, you know what they say, beggars can't be choosy.
But choosy moms choose Jeff.
That's true. Damn it. Well, again.
And the other thing I wanted to point out was that apparently, if you have version 3 something of Firefox, you can't use Google Plus. I mean, you can see it on the screen right now. I have it pulled up and it says your browser's not supported. I thought it was because I was running Linux, but no. It's because even Google has dropped support for old Firefoxes.
Foiled again, Batman.
Seriously. Bothers me to no end.
That's two versions out of date now.
It really is. That bothers me.
Dude, I gave you a segue twice and you totally blew it.
Oh, do it again, do it again. Boom, bop, bap.
Foiled again, Batman.
Speaking of Batman, we have an article about the Batphone app, which is not quite what you think it is. You hear Batphone and you immediately picture, you know, Batman talking on his Batphone. But this is not really the same. This kind of goes back to what, Ryan, you were talking about earlier with pinpointing people. And, you know, Matt, you brought up IP geolocation or whatever. This is similar, but the Batphone app is attempting to use audio fingerprints to determine where you are inside, because we're good at picking out people via GPS outside. But once you get inside, GPS doesn't work so hot. So this Batphone app lets you tag places that are inside based on their fingerprints. You walk around, you say, this is my kitchen, record. And it records 10 seconds of data, and there's the fingerprint for your kitchen. And now they can pinpoint you based on what your phone hears while you're walking around. Do you see a need for pinpointing people inside of places?
Yeah, for those certain people that have those 50,000 square foot houses and, you know, their kids can't find them
in
anymore.
Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could be useful in office buildings too.
Yeah.
The, you know, people who deploy Wi-Fi networks and stuff like to be able to use their smartphones and portable devices to, you know, check Wi-Fi strength and that kind of thing and automatically make a map, basically.
Right.
I'm curious to try it. I haven't tried it yet. I just want to know how robust it is, you know, when the environment varies, if I have the windows open versus closed, if the central air is on versus off.
Well, they do say, what is it? They tried a bunch of different ways. It's some sort of passive recording, but they filter out all kinds of things. They filter out transient, short-lived sounds like someone talking. So I'm guessing they're able to get rid of, like, air conditioners and talking. And
oh, but I think the continuous things like air conditioners are the basis for the the recognition.
That could be because that's not a short-lived thing.
Right. I think it's using that background noise, like, you know, the fan of your computer at the blow of your air conditioning and that kind of thing. So I'm just curious about how robust it is.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be able to tag my upstairs because my air conditioner isn't always on.
Or you could tag it twice with two fingerprints. That'd be the only way I could see it working.
Yeah.
If they support like two fingerprints for a location, that may reduce the or increase the amount of ambiguity between different locations if the fingerprints are very similar. I still have to say though, when I read this article, I was like, wow, they can do this? Like,
yeah, it's very cool.
That was impressive to me that the fidelity of the microphone provided enough of a repeatable, consistent signature that even if, let's just assume the air conditioning's always on, that they could repeatably say that's the same room. That's
yeah, but
impressive.
It's probably doing a match against only the places you've tagged, right?
Well, so, right. Yeah, but yeah, still.
So
yeah.
Your best match out of five isn't...
That's true.
...isn't as awesome as, you know, a global match or something like that.
Oh, this is not good. I just installed the Batphone application, and I just opened it, and the first thing it did was take a fingerprint of my current room, which it got all of us talking.
Oh.
What should filter that out is transients.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll find out. I don't know what it's... I can't figure this out right now.
However, the room is, you know, permanently linked to Ryan's laptop fan.
Yeah. It'll only work when I'm here.
Oh, so my basement doesn't exist outside of when Ryan's here.
Nope.
Not cool, Ryan. Sorry. Not cool. So our last two articles kind of go together. And they're all about RIM. Or what this one person says should be, just be BlackBerry. So an open letter was written to the higher-ups at BlackBerry, at RIM, sorry. I'm just going to call them BlackBerry, because that's what I call them. To the higher-ups at BlackBerry, from an employee of BlackBerry, telling them all the crap that's wrong with them. And I have in the article list, if you click on the link, a bunch of highlights of what I think are the finer points of this article. I'll just read a couple of them. You guys can, you know, interrupt me and comment as we go along. Once I get to a video, I want to play a couple minutes of a video. But he says, first, you know, focus on the end user experience. Let's obsess about what is best for the end user. Apple is nailing this, and it's one of the reasons they have people lining up overnight at stores around the world, and products are sold out for months. Android has a major weakness. It will always lack the simplicity and elegance that comes with end-to-end software, middleware, and hardware control. So that's basically point one. He says, we do too much stuff. We don't control the infrastructure. We don't make an experience like Apple was doing. You know, we don't want to copy Apple, but we need to do something different than what we're doing. Do you guys see that? I see this as a problem with RIM in general.
What I thought was interesting is that he talks about Android in comparison to iPhone and not so much what BlackBerry's weaknesses are compared to iPhone. And then he brings up, oh yeah, we need to get this QNX platform rolling. I don't think the OS has really anything to do with it, you know, in the end, because if you look at the iPhone when it first came out, the OS is fairly simplistic. Like, it, you know, it didn't really support much multitasking at the time.
Any at all.
It didn't support copy and paste. I mean, these are, copy and paste is like, you know, when that's like a kind of a function, like it's almost like taking away
your right hand
of an, it's like taking away like a screen to like look at, to interact with the computer, and going back to like, you know, printouts. It's really like that big of a change, in my opinion. So like, it was very, very primitive, but that's not really, it wasn't the OS. It wasn't a problem. Like, so I don't think he has any point there that the OS is the problem. It's always, always, always going to be the HMI. You know, the man-machine interface is what is going to make or break a product.
He may have been pointing a little bit more towards, like, application crashes and OS crashes. Like, I know a couple of people who have the Storm and other things,
yeah.
and they complain sometimes about the phone freezes. You know, that's something that the iPhone doesn't do. That's something that, I mean, Android kind of does sometimes, but that's something they need to work on. And I think that's why he pointed out QNX. Because, you know, it's a very stable Unix platform, so those problems won't exist anymore.
Maybe.
I don't know. He didn't say that. That's just what I got out of it.
I mean, Android's... I don't understand how... I mean, I know QNX is solid, but I don't...
Well, QNX is Unix. Android is Linux.
Yeah, so, but...
BlackBerry is neither of the two. It's their own concoction.
I don't even know what it's based on.
Yeah, I have no idea.
But I just don't think that in the end, that's going to make or break it. I think really, there are things that... I think what totally sold the iPhone from the get-go is that it had such a good touch interface. That's really what it did the best over all of the other smartphones out there.
Right.
It had a knock you dead touch interface almost from the get-go. It was a little bit sketchy. It got really good in the second version.
Well, you know, let's move on to some other points, because he kind of says that, you know, all of these points together are things we need to work on. So the next couple points, we need some heavy hitters at RIM when it comes to software management. So he's saying that we don't have people in charge of the projects who know what they're doing. We need people who do this stuff. And there's a serious need to consolidate and focus just a handful of projects, period. Strategy is often in the things you decide not to do. So that's kind of like we talked about Microsoft. They do too much.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised to hear this criticism of RIM, because it's not obvious to me that they're doing a whole lot of different things.
Yeah, maybe this guy has some insider information that
yeah,
they just
I'm sure.
yeah, do yeah. too many projects and they need to stop. I don't know.
I mean, they really make only a couple base OSs. You know, I mean, like it's there's different releases of it, but it's just a branch of the same code, for as far as I know.
Right, same way Android does with their tablet interface and their phone interface.
And even at that, like, I mean, the phones are still like one product to me. I mean, maybe there's too much hardware. Maybe there's too many like different like too.
There too are much, a lot of BlackBerries,
right? But like, maybe there's too much silicon. Like, maybe they're targeting too many chips, and it's making, you know, trouble for the integration teams and stuff like that. That could be a big deal. Like, you know, there's trackballs and optical things and touch screens and all that stuff. I could see that possibly being his complaint. I mean, if they, it just seems to me though that what they lack is sort of a sanity check at the end. Like, you know, everyone hyped up that Storm like it was going to be the most awesome thing in the world. That click thing they came out with,
it was horrible.
Great. I mean, good thinking out of the box. I think if it was done well, it could work. But it was terrible. The first version, like the thing that it should have done, no matter what, is it, and I know you don't like this, but it wasn't consistent in its clicking. Like, you know, like you could graze a button and it would still click, or you could click down on that screen and it would also click.
You could tap or you could click.
Right. It should have been one or the other. If you're going to do that click thing, then do not commit a click until I press the screen. That way you can easily decipher in the software between a swipe and a click. Like, that would have made their life so much easier on the interface side if they would just done that, you know, and they totally biffed it. I mean, that's the stuff that I think that they're just missing a sanity check. Like, really? You're going to release this product? I mean, there are some really bad smartphones out there, but I think the Storm was one of the worst, you know, in terms of the interface to it.
Yeah, and here's you mentioned a sanity check. I think these next 2 points really drive that home. Well, the next one really drives that home. There's no polite way to say this, but it's true. BlackBerry smartphone apps suck. Developing for the BlackBerry is painful. The development platform is like a rundown 1990s Ford Explorer. This is coming from a guy who works at the company and does this stuff. And I think that, you know, you listen to any tech show that talks about any phones or any tablets, and everybody says the same thing. Apps are why you buy a device. You know,
they may be. I mean, I'm sorry to keep jumping in, Matt. I don't know if you have it, but like with my BlackBerry, and I've had one now for a little over 2 years, I have no complaints on the apps. Like, I have all the apps that I need. That like, I have a really nice weather app. I can access Google Maps. I can get Gmail. There's not a lot of games, but I wouldn't probably play the games anyways. Like, I'm just not a game player.
Right.
And so, like, you know, I have a Twitter client, have a Foursquare client, Facebook client, all that stuff. It's all there, and it works well. None of them, it never crashes. So the only thing that happens is, you know, it's multitasking management. If it can get a little unwieldy where you have to, like, sort of go in and shut the apps down, that's about the only thing I complain about. And even at that, it's really not that bad.
Well, let's look at it this way, though. Let's a person who doesn't own a smartphone. They go into a store and they see your BlackBerry and my iPhone side by side. They get to play with them, see which one they like better. They're coming away with an iPhone just because the apps are flashier, they're prettier, they respond a little better. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's what this guy was getting at.
I still don't think it's the apps. I think it's the interface. People are now...
Well, it's the development.
I think touch is the way forward for small devices. That's the thing. Like, I'm not sure touch fits on a desktop yet. You know, like, that's something even Steve Jobs, you know, I'm not taking credit for that or anything, or, you know,
they owe you a dollar.
Yeah, no. he said that first. It maybe doesn't belong on the desktop. And I don't know that it does or doesn't, but it definitely belongs in the thing. I'm not saying it should be the only interface. I still like hard buttons for certain things. I think the all touch is wrong as well. I mean, I still want a hard volume button. I want a hard mute button. I want a button that when I switch it, I know that I don't have to rely on the software to correctly interpret my gesture. I want it, you know, to be able to command it to do, like, completely shut off, for instance. Do not make a sound. That's you know, in my opinion, something every phone needs. But anyway, I still think it comes down to interface. Yes. I really do. And so, that's why the apps seem like they're better. I think the interface is better.
So let's take a 180 from the interface, and let's go to the last point that I want to talk about. I have a couple more highlighted, but this is the big one. This guy says that RIM has a need for some serious marketing punch. He says, I've never seen somebody buy product B because it has something product A doesn't have. People buy product B because they want and lust after product B. Now, that might not make sense, but before we talk about this, let me play a couple minutes from this YouTube video that they link. It's a talk from TED, and it's basically all about marketing and how a company should market.
Complete opposite to everyone else. All I did was codify it. And it's probably the world's simplest idea. I call it the golden circle. Why, how, what? This little idea explains why some organizations and some leaders are able to inspire where others aren't. Let me define the terms really quickly. Every single person, every single organization on the planet knows what they do 100%. Some know how they do it, whether you call it your differentiating value proposition or your proprietary process or your USP. But very, very few people or organizations know why they do what they do. And by why, I don't mean to make a profit. That's a result. It's always a result. By why, I mean, what's your purpose? What's your cause? What's your belief? Why does your organization exist? Why do you get out of bed in the morning? And why should anyone care? Well, as a result, the way we think, the way we act, the way we communicate is from the outside in. It's obvious. We go from the clearest thing to the fuzziest thing. But the inspired leaders and the inspired organizations, regardless of their size, regardless of their industry, all think, act, and communicate from the inside out. Let me give you an example. I use Apple because they're easy to understand and everybody gets it. If Apple were like everyone else, a marketing message from them might sound like this. We make great computers. They're beautifully designed, simple to use, and user-friendly. Want to buy one? Meh. And that's how most of us communicate. That's how most marketing is done, that's how most sales is done, and that's how most of us communicate interpersonally. We say what we do, we say how we're different or how we better, and we expect some sort of behavior, a purchase, a vote, something like that. Here's our new law firm. We have the best lawyers with the biggest clients. We have, you know, we always perform for our clients, do business with us. Here's our new car. It gets great gas mileage, it has, you know, leather seats. Buy our car. But it's uninspiring. Here's how Apple actually communicates. Everything we do, we believe in challenging the status quo. We believe in thinking differently. The way we challenge the status quo is by making our products beautifully designed, simple to use, and user-friendly. We just happen to make great computers. Want to buy one? Totally different, right? You're ready to buy a computer from me. All I did was reverse the order of the information. What it proves to us is that people don't buy what you do, people buy why you do it. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. This explains why every single person in this room is perfectly comfortable buying a computer from Apple. But we're also perfectly comfortable buying an MP3 player from Apple, or a phone from Apple, or a DVR from Apple. But as I said before, Apple's just a computer company. There's nothing that distinguishes them structurally from any of their competitors. Their competitors are all equally qualified to make all of these products. In fact, they tried. A few years ago, Gateway came out with flat-screen TVs. They're eminently qualified to make flat-screen TVs. They've been making flat-screen monitors for years. Nobody bought one.
So I think that's a good place to stop it right there. So this guy says, you know, this is how RIM, or what he says should be renamed to BlackBerry, should market. And this is why Apple was so good at it. What do you guys think of this whole reverse thinking? Say why you do it. People don't buy what you do. They buy why you do it.
In my honest opinion, I don't think that the average person pays attention to Apple's commercials. They go into the Verizon store or the AT&T store. They use the phone. It's glossy, big screen, and it has a touch interface. I really think that's why they buy it.
And the same goes for computers. Why would somebody buy an Apple computer rather than an HP or a Dell or whatever?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the same thing. But Apple is not leading the market in selling computers. Yes, they are crushing the higher end market right now, but they don't lead the market in selling computers. They never have, and they're getting their asses kicked by Android right now. The Android's like hot on their heels, and the reason is because the Android phones are big, black, glossy, and touchscreens now. That's that simple. It has nothing to do with. There are, I will agree with this guy. There are people who buy into the cause, but that his whole video is proof that it's a shill. Like that, it's just, oh, buy us because we believe in what we do, and we think differently. Like, there are people that do buy into that, and you're allowed to. It's like the people that buy BMWs. I mean, there's a driving experience. And yeah, BMWs probably, you know, they have a feel to them. It's like, whatever. But you know what? I can have just as much fun in a little four-banger driving around. You know, it's just lightweight and good power-to-weight ratio.
Right.
That's really all most BMWs are.
So are you basically saying that marketing, not that big of a deal that this guy makes it out to be?
I don't think it's a big deal, and I think the fact that he says that it is proves that what Apple sells you really is just mindshare.
Matt, any ideas? Thoughts?
I don't have a lot of thoughts connecting this to RIM, because I I mean, they've hardly been in my mind. I've never used a BlackBerry device. I've never considered a BlackBerry device. To me, they have been tools of the corporate tool, and just not something that has appealed to me as a device.
The reason I picked the BlackBerry and I've stuck with it is because I do a lot of text entry on my phone, and it's hands down the fastest thing that I can use to enter text into a phone with.
Oh, boo. I'll give you my phone. You play with it for 3 hours. I said the same thing. I was raised smartphone-wise on Trios and Windows Mobile like 5.0 devices that had real keyboards, and that was awesome to have a keyboard on my phone. I got this thing. It sucked for the first 3 or 4 hours. I hated it. I was slow. I screwed up everything. After 3 hours, I could type faster than anybody I know on my phone. I think it would be the same thing with you. You're just as good with technology.
I am, but I still think that humans are still meant to have tactile feedback on what they do. Our bodies are built to receive tactile feedback on when we make an action.
See, that was the hardest thing for me, you know, telling my mind, forget about tactile feedback. You don't need to see the right word on the screen.
Yeah, but why do I want to tell my body to forget about its natural
state? Because
you
can be faster.
No, it's not. Here's when non-tactile feedback will be a better input method. When they can actually tap into your brain waves, which I don't think is too far away. I read an article today that on Engadget that they can actually now read your brain waves and decide which way you want to move your hand, which is a pretty big step. You know, like they say, okay, think of a way you want to move your hand, and they can tell now.
That's awesome.
Because they have a camera on your hand in a black box, which way it moves. So they know, they can confirm what the computer, measured. Anyway, when they get to that point and they can predict what you want to type, you know, like they put a little implant in you, it's got a Wi-Fi connection to your
iPhone. Words appear on the screen.
And you see words appear on the screen, I will buy an iPhone, okay? I will give up on tactile feedback when that happens.
Honestly.
There's also research, by the way, that your mind makes up its mind before you are consciously aware that you've made up your mind.
Oh, really?
So you may actually get a phone that knows what you want to say before you know what you want to say.
You look at
that
your phone.
That would
and
be weird.
Yeah, I pulled my phone out of my pocket and there's already a text message written. Like, whoa.
It's like it like connects to the id, like the urge.
Yeah, yeah.
That'll be something whenever you get a response to a text message that you didn't know you sent.
Oh, man.
It'll just say, Tulum Southside Saloon.
But, oh, what? Okay.
I really was thinking about going there.
It would be weird. I think it'd be weird to be felt like you were led around by a piece of technology all your life. Oh, wait a minute.
So our last article, I mean, I don't want to talk about it that much unless you guys saw something in here. It was just the RIM executives responding to that open letter. And what I got out of this was they said, we don't care.
Yeah, that's the thing. This letter, we've gotten all hot and bothered about it and mainly talked about Apple. But I think that RIM is doing a good job. I just think I don't think their market share is going to dry up. I think it's going to go down, but not because of Apple, because of Android.
Well, because of everybody else.
Yeah, because there's competition. They right. didn't have any competition in the United States until these two competitors finally found their way. You know, like, because overseas RIM doesn't have as much of a. They've never had much of a. Impact over there because Nokia was so much more popular with Symbian and everything else. Yeah. So, you know, I think that this is just the natural course of the market. RIM's market shares definitely go down. I think if they continue to put out good products like some of the ones they have, like the Tour is always, the Bold has been a popular device.
My mom's camera's broken on hers, by the way.
Oh, is it? Well, that sucks. Well, I can't tell you how many friends I've had that have broken their iPhones, so I don't think they're any much better.
I chipped the bottom of mine. Although I was an idiot and dropped it on my garage floor.
I know someone who's been through 8, and that was actually as of 3 years or 2 years ago.
See, that I do not understand. Like, yes, the entire thing is glass. I have never had a shattered screen. Yeah. I don't treat my phones like crap. You know, they're
well,
always
yeah,
in my
but
pocket.
Some people, yeah, right. But some people are doing like super manual labor. Like,
don't
you know,
carry your phone in your pocket.
Well, they need to have a, they want to have, what if I want a communications device that doesn't break when I like, you know, smash something in my pocket?
Buy one of those ruggedized, rubber covered Sprint phones.
Exactly.
Or buy an OtterBox for your iPhone.
Well, you could, right. I mean, but they're coming to market, but still I have to buy the iPhone and buy this box and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, getting back to this open letter from, you know, or RIM's response, I think, RIM didn't take it seriously. I think if you're a corporation like RIM, you shouldn't take it seriously, because since it's anonymous, like they said, they don't know if it's real. I mean, they do probably know if it's real, because there'll probably be some points in there. But that letter was really generic. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh, you need a better software process. QNX seems like it's really... These are all things that have been in the news that you could probably totally conjure up. So I don't know that there's any proof that it's real.
It is. We have received an open letter to Mike and Jim from a high-level RIM employee whose identity we have verified from the Boy Genius report.
Oh.
So these guys know who the person who wrote the letter is.
Well, then maybe they should have addressed it directly, but it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter, because whether they address it or whether they don't, what in the end, what matters is if they come out with a product that has the features that people want, the hot features. Like, that's really what it boils down to. But it's about the hot features, and it's got to be done well. Like, you can't have a touchscreen on it that doesn't work. It's got to work.
I think a big part of it is an app platform that small developers want to develop for.
They have some problems. It's like $500 to get into their app they're developing.
Yeah, and just to be fun and make people want to do it. You mentioned getting Facebook and Twitter and all those clients, which makes sense because those are the big companies that can develop for every platform. But, you know, I have apps on my iPod Touch that I like, you know, to tell me when satellites are going overhead and to keep a bird checklist and stuff like that. And I'm not sure that the same sort of lush ecosystem exists for the BlackBerry devices, because I don't hear about small, you know, 20-year-old single person developers wanting to target that platform because it's a fun thing to do.
Well, that's the thing. Not only is developing for the BlackBerry not fun, it's not easy.
I don't have any experience developing for any of the platforms, but I don't think Objective-C is all that, you know, like a
walk in the park
either.
Have you used Xcode though? Like, the interface makes it easy.
Okay, so the interface helps, and maybe they have some old archaic system to develop.
Well, that's what this guy was pointing out. He's like, it's not...
I am not a mobile developer, so...
Yeah, I mean, he's comparing it to a 1990s Ford Explorer, and the people I know who develop iOS applications, or to some extent the Android applications, don't talk about the development environment that way.
Right, you don't...
Yeah.
And when you develop for those, you really don't think about the environment.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know what they use, but I mean, Android uses Eclipse. Like, that's your primary interface. I mean, most people, because it's Java, right?
It's a type. Yeah, you have like a plugin for Eclipse that does your Android
stuff.
So
I mean,
stuff.
And Eclipse sucks. Like, I hate Eclipse.
Yeah, but it's definitely plausible that BlackBerry's environment is worse.
It could be. I would imagine. I thought it was. Probably, I mean, their apps are Java too, so I figured they would be Eclipse, but...
But it's not just the development environment, it's the SDKs and everything too.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There's ease of use and all that stuff, but I really doubt it. Like, for me though, like, difficulty of the environment is not something that... I don't know. It's just a different world now. There's so many developers now, like, you know... Software developers were, like, not a dime a dozen 20 years ago, and now they are. So I guess it's just, you know, if you want people to develop applications for your platform, it's got to be basically, like, 4GL languages, where it's just, like, pretty pictures that they snap together and it makes an application.
BlackBerry is Java that uses Eclipse.
Yeah. So the environment can't be that bad. I mean, the SDK could be terrible. I agree. It could be terrible. But still, it sounds to me like somebody just wanted to bitch out loud about their job because they lost it. That's probably what it is.
I think he did have a couple good points, though. And I think it was kind of funny that the one point that you made, you know, people want the hot products, was the exact opposite of what this guy said. He's like, nobody buys stuff because of the hot features.
Who does?
That's what that guy said in the
article. I know, and I disagree with him. I mean, I disagree with his assessment of it. I do not think that people buy Apple products because of an ideal. Like, it's like saying that people buy, like, Chevys because of an ideal, or like Hondas.
Well,
people
around here.
Yeah.
Well, the ideal is just that we want to beat up Ford. That's the only ideal. Like,
that's good enough for me.
And if you buy, like, if you're buying a Honda, the reason you buy a Honda is because you think they're reliable. And whether they are or not is irrelevant. You just think they're, you think they're reliable. And that's mainly just word of mouth. Like,
right.
Honda doesn't, like, they don't tout their reliability. They just say, oh, a Honda Accord won the J.D. Powers Associate Award. They do that every year in their freaking commercial. That's Honda advertising.
I wonder how many more cars they would sell if they did the inside-out method.
Maybe they would sell more, but I don't know. I mean, okay, fine. Maybe this guy's right, and you do the inside-out method, and then every company does the inside-out method. How do you differentiate?
Well, then you know what companies actually believe.
And you find out a lot of them don't believe anything. Or stand for anything.
Yeah, but I still, I don't know that believing or standing for anything is what selling products is about.
That's why I have a Mac.
But
that's why I drive a car engineered by BMW.
Yeah, but I don't. So you're saying you're suckers for marketing.
No, we're saying that this core belief actually motivates the design process and
the people who work there want to work there.
Yeah. Yeah, but then what motivates Honda?
Precision engineering? I mean,
I don't know.
But that's the thing, like that's the farce. Honda doesn't have, like, people think they're reliable because they're Japanese. Toyota's the one that has like the amazing reliability record.
I didn't say reliability. I said precision engineering. About the, you know, in the mid 90s, Honda was getting 100 horsepower per liter from naturally aspirated engines.
Yeah.
They Honda to me signifies engine design and
small with the engine design.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess
Honda does have an image to me, the small high output, small displacement engines.
I guess the way this guy presents it though is that if you advertise this way, then it's like that's what makes you want to buy the product. But I'm saying Honda does not advertise.
I think he's saying though that if they told people what they actually believe, that would be better for them. Just like if BlackBerry told people what they actually believe, why they believe it, that would be better for BlackBerry.
Yeah, but this is to say that BlackBerry doesn't have core beliefs.
No, this is to say that BlackBerry doesn't tell us that they have core beliefs.
No, that's the thing. You guys are saying two different things. You're saying that having the core belief makes you make better products, and then they sell themselves. Or you tell people that you have this belief. Maybe your engineers catch on, but people buy it because you have this belief. Like it's
people buy it because they know that you have it and that you actually do have it. It's both together.
How do you tell that they actually do it? Like that's the thing. You don't know that they do it
because the products end up on the marketplace and you see the results.
Yeah, but there's a lot of room in the market for things that explains Android success then?
It's commodity. There's 100 people making it, and for a long time it was all you could get on a lot of carriers.
Yeah, so this guy's this is the solution to your problems. I don't think it's a solution. It's one way to do it.
Well, I think right now, you know, with Android, there has been no inside-out marketing. So I think that they already have the one thing. You know, they have the result. People see the result that there's lots of phones that are all cheap. Anybody can buy it. They work just as well as the iPhone. I bet if they were to change their marketing and show people what their core beliefs were, that would put the two things together and more people would get on board because they see, oh, Android is not just some huge company shoveling out software on every phone they possibly can. A reason.
I just don't think that every product in the world is based on core beliefs.
Dyson.
I think, huh?
Dyson.
Yeah, okay, there's another example, but the guy that sells beef, like, it's beef. Like, he feeds his cattle, like, you know, corn-fed or whatever type of fed, grass-fed cattle, and he advertises whatever kind of cattle, and then the supermarket buys it, and you know what? You go to Giant Eagle, you're like, sirloin or Delmonico?
Hmm. Well, you might, but a lot of people might go there and look at the ones and say, oh, grass-fed organic or crap.
Go to Giant Eagle. I go to local meat.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but
meat markets because the product is superior.
See, I think we just have two different beliefs in how we buy stuff. You know, I think that's the real argument here. Is you look at things one way, I look at things another way, Matt looks at things another way.
Right, but I just don't think that this guy's statement that selling your product this way is the only way to do it. Like it's.
But I don't think he's suggesting that it's purely a marketing technique. I think he wants you to have the core belief to draw from. You're probably right that not every product in the marketplace originates with a core belief, and that's a failing in some sense.
Yeah,
I just think the way the market works is there's a hole. There's a need for the product. The product doesn't exist. People want a certain thing. And when that gap is filled with a product, demand rises on it, and then...
Well, think about the gap now. What are the gaps nowadays? They're not that something doesn't exist, because pretty much everything exists. Most things just suck. So now you get somebody to come in and have a core belief that we're going to do this the right way, because this is what people want. And now here is our product that fills this gap the right way. That's the people you buy from.
Not if it costs me twice as much to own it.
And, see, for me, that's not a big deal.
And it still goes obsolete in the same amount of time. Like, I just think it's ridiculous to spend $5,000 on a computer when in 2 or 3 years it's going to be obsolete.
Well, look at the Tesla Roadster. You know, limited production. They had a core belief that vehicles could be mass produced, all electronic or all electric, you know, no gas. Sure, they're going to be expensive.
100-mile range.
They're going to be expensive. Yeah, but you're paying for the research. You're buying into their core belief that we get enough people to buy this car, this will make the production for our sedan that is much better.
We're arguing a completely different. We're arguing early adopter. Then there's a whole different mentality.
I think it
kind of
goes along. You get people on the train of your core beliefs, and it helps your company in one way or another.
I don't think there's anything that Apple has. Like, there's no technology specifically that Apple has that other companies don't have or can't license from another company.
I agree.
You know what I mean? Like, there's no early adopter syndrome with them.
That kind of just proves our point, though, that it's all in the marketing and the beliefs because they don't have anything different. Everybody has everything.
But what Apple has is the integration. They're vertically integrated, you know, the whole way from the hardware to the software, and they pull together a package that other vendors don't seem to be able to do at the same price.
Well, that definitely helps. I agree that the fact that they have access to all their hardware software teams makes a better final, like, polished product.
And I think that's what we're getting at in a lot of this core belief is that polish
is the seller.
But if that was the case, then Android wouldn't be popular.
But Apple's making more money
right now, and that's only because of their stupid App Store terms. That has nothing to do with the device sales. The device sales are like the drop in the bucket. They're not making much on those iPhones at all. It's all apps. It's all app sales.
Yeah, but they have to be selling the devices to sell the apps.
Right, but they could sell the apps on anything. They could just open their platform up to anything and sell apps anywhere. You know,
they could, but then it's not a vertically integrated market. You know, they can't control stuff then.
They're still not killing it though, like in terms of device sales. Like,
oh, they're not.
I mean,
no.
They may make a lot of money, but there's lots of companies that made a lot of money and, you know, are starting to like falter. Microsoft. You know, it's like there's this, you know, Microsoft had core beliefs. They wanted the desktop on every, or a computer on every desk in the world.
Was that a core belief or was that a get rich quick scheme?
No, that was just, that was what they believed in, that they thought they could bring computing to the masses. You know, and that's what they did. But I mean,
Microsoft and Apple both have very high margins.
They did.
They still do. They are still extremely profitable companies.
Microsoft, I guess, is somewhat profitable. I mean, it's still
extremely profitable. It has like a 50% gross margin.
Right, but its market share is going down. The profits are starting to. I'm saying it's not as profitable as it was. Like in. With respect to the price, you know, the value of dollar 10, 15 years ago.
I'm not sure that's true. I mean, they're setting earnings records still, I thought.
Maybe they are.
Since Windows 7 came out, they've been an extremely profitable company.
Sorry, I was just trying to look up information at the same time that we're arguing to see if I can find anything, but I'm having trouble. So let's end that conversation there because I think I want to hear from our viewers, our listeners. I want to see what you guys think. Do you think that this open letter to RIM was 100% good? Every point he made was good? Do you agree with Ryan? Do you agree with me? Do you agree with Matt? What do you guys think in terms of how RIM needs to turn themselves around, or if they do need to turn themselves around? Let us know. Send us an email at slonkast@kevinslonka.com. You know, let us know what you think. We'll get your comments on the air. You send us an email. That's also the same email you can send questions to. That's the end of the show. Did you guys have any other things that you saw during the past week or so? Pretty much cover everything. Cool. Well, you can contact me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slonkak. Ryan, where do people go if they want to talk to you?
You can get me on www.lancipedia.com or on Twitter /RyanLancy.
And Matt, how do people get in contact with you?
My blog is Scotch Tape and Duct Whiskey at ductwhiskey, ductwhisky.com.
Very cool. And as always, if you want to submit an article for next week's show, tag it on Delicious as Slongcast039 next week. Actually, it's not going to be next week because I'll be in Vegas for work. So maybe I can work together too bad. Poor me. Maybe I can pull together a remote session, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to be tied off with things in Vegas next week.
Gambling?
No, I will not gamble. I did that before in a couple of casinos in Pittsburgh and in Niagara, and I just lose money.
So I don't want to do that anymore. And I have a feeling in Vegas I will lose a lot more money. So anyways, that is it for this week's edition of the Slalcast. Dovi Zania.